Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Today, we discuss hoarding. Many of us accumulate things, but when does collecting become hoarding? For some, the impulse to collect and keep things is difficult to control and can impact mental and physical welfare. Joining us this morning, psychiatrist Mark Whaley. Good morning.
Good morning, Mindy.
Psychiatrist Jonathan Schwartz. Good morning to you.
Hi there.
Social worker Jenny Putnam. Hi, Jenny.
Hi.
And in studio with me is Denise Egan-Stack. She is on the International OCD Foundation Board of Directors and the Scientific and Clinical Advisory Board. She's treated people with OCD and related disorders for over 25 years and was a founding staff member of the McLean Hospital OCD Institute in 1997 and has served as the mental health consultant for the Cape Cod Hoarding Task Force for over 10 years. Welcome back. Good to see you.
Good to see you, too. Thank you. Good morning.
So I guess let's start with the hoarding versus OCD. We thought at one point that they were similar, the same, but they're different. So just explain that part.
Right.
For us.
Yeah. So for many years, we considered hoarding behavior as a symptom of OCD. When I started treating people with OCD in the late 90s, that was considered a symptom of hoarding. But over the course of about 25 years, we've accumulated lots of data that helped establish the fact that there are important differences between OCD and hoarding. So, for example, there are genetic differences, there are neurobiological differences, and there is a major difference in the treatment outcome between the two disorders. Yeah. So at this point, as of 2013, actually, in the DSM-5, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual 5th Edition, the manual that we use in the fields of psychology and psychiatry to determine whether or not people have certain psychiatric conditions, we separated them out. So it's no longer under the umbrella of OCD. It's now a separate disorder. It's considered a related disorder.
So tell us what hoarding is then.
So hoarding disorder is a complex psychiatric condition, and you have to meet certain criteria to be diagnosed with hoarding disorder. There are six of them, and they're pretty clearly spelled out in the DSM-5. The first one is that people have difficulty parting with their possessions, regardless of the value of the possessions. The second criteria is that people have difficulty parting with their possessions because they have a perceived need to save them for sentimental reasons, intrinsic reasons, instrumental reasons, or it's just so hard. They experience such high levels of distress when they're trying to part with their belongings that they just don't do it. It's just too hard to handle. And because of that, the third criteria is that people develop a large volume of clutter in their household that makes living spaces unusable as intended. So people may not eat at their kitchen table. They may not sleep in their bed. They may not bathe in their bathroom. They may not cook on their stove. And so that all creates, number four criteria, is that it creates distress in people's lives and it impairs their day-to-day functioning. So, for example, people may have legal issues because they cannot find and pay their bills. They may be in financial distress because they have overspent on acquiring items, or they're paying high storage rental fees every single month. Their job may be in jeopardy because they can't find their keys, and so they're getting out the door too late, or they are missing too much work. People with hoarding disorder tend to miss about 7 days of work a month.
Wow.
And then they may not be parenting effectively, et cetera. And then we want to make sure that 5 and 6, that these symptoms are not attributable to another medical condition like a brain injury, stroke, or dementia, and they're not attributable to another psychiatric condition like depression or ADHD.
So how common is it?
It's surprisingly pretty prevalent.
Yeah.
The prevalence rate is pretty high. It's about 4%. So when you look at the research, the numbers range between 2 and 6%, but we sort of settle right in the middle at 4%.
And so so we have pretty good statistics on the number of people who have this tendency. And are there varying degrees? I mean, or is it kind of all or nothing?
Oh, no, there are varying degrees. There's varying degrees of hoarding behavior. And so we have a range of assessment scales that we use. One of the ones that I really like is called the Clutter Image Rating Scale, and it gives pictures of what spaces look like for severity. So it's easy to use with your clients. And so that'll help us determine severity of hoarding behavior. But there's also varying levels of insight, too. So when you're working to diagnose someone with hoarding, we're looking at two other things. We're looking at whether or not there's excessive acquiring, compulsive shopping. The inflow into the house is much, much greater than the outflow from the house. And we're also looking at the level of insight. Mm-hmm. So is it, poor, medium, high? Because both of those have implications for treatment.
So I'm thinking of the rest of you guys, like, how do you know? I mean, if somebody doesn't really have that insight, you're going on what family members say, hey, mom's a hoarder. What do we do?
Essentially. Yeah. That's very typical. These people really do not generally present for treatment on their own saying that I have a problem with this. I mean, people can, but it's not something that is very common. If we get to treatment or speaking of treatment now, if you could tell us how you try to engage the people that don't have any insight into the issue itself, that it's not a problem for them. Everybody else is bothered by it, but they're, you know, they're crazy. I should be able to, I live in a free country. I should be able to keep what I want to keep and live the way I want to live. How do you go about trying to overcome those resistances?
Right. So let me just say first that the standard treatment for people with hoarding disorder is cognitive behavioral therapy. And so that can be delivered individually, and it's also been modified to be as a group or a self-help group, which is Buried in Treasures Workshop, which I'm sure we'll talk about a little bit later, or to be delivered remotely. And for people who do present for treatment, it is fairly effective, although it is time-consuming, it is expensive, and it's hard to find someone who knows how to do it. But you're right that there are many people who have low insight and don't know what all the fuss is about, right? Mm-hmm. So their children are really upset with them, their neighbors are upset with them, their community's upset with them. And so that's really where the hoarding task forces come in. We work together in a coordinated community level response to try to engage them with sometimes, you know, we're a team and it might be like a carrot and a stick. So the Cape Cod Hoarding Task Force chair, Erica Woods, might come in as a health agent and, you know, sort of issue citations for what's going on. And then there may be other people that come in and say like, well, you know, this is really difficult. And, you know, they're going to continue to come and monitor your progress. There may be trouble down the line. Let me try to help you. Like, you know, let me try to help you figure out what we can do here. So we might offer people access to the various groups that we have running on the Cape. We might work with family members or friends to coach them on how they might help with harm reduction. So it might not necessarily be just about sorting and discarding your possessions, but it might be about helping to reorganize your possessions so that we're reducing the risk of fall, of fire, of respiratory illness. So there's lots of different ways. You know, clinically, you guys all know motivational interviewing. So we're trying to help people understand, you know, work through what's in it for them. How is this behavior preventing them from living a life according to their value system, or in what way is it costing them? And then helping them really focus on what they could get back if they were to engage in this really difficult behavior. People are very overwhelmed. They have executive functioning issues. We're teaching them the skills, executive functioning skills, decision-making skills, organizational skills. So there's just lots of ways to come at it.
Yeah.
Tell me, what about mandatory treatment? Do you ever get people that under a court order to have treatment?
Not necessarily. I mean, I think that when someone owns their home, it's really hard to get them to engage in this. I mean, they can, unless it's posing some sort of like real public health concern. If you somehow get into a house, if someone falls and first responders come in and there's urine or feces or there's squalor, you know, the town can go in there and then it's a real problem. But if it doesn't get to that level, it's really hard to get people to engage. But if you're renting, you know, if you're a part of the public health system or public housing system, or you're renting an apartment, you can get kicked out. You have a high risk for homelessness. But I don't think I've ever really been involved in a case where there's a court order unless people are trying to keep their house. Yeah. You know, it's a court order that you have to manage your stuff, but not necessarily for treatment.
So let's step back for a second and talk about the differences. So what are the characteristics of a hoarder that separate them from someone who likes to collect things?
Right.
So, and our hoarders, are they sometimes collecting things?
Yeah. Many times hoarders like to refer to themselves as collectors. But when you're thinking about people who are truly collecting, they tend to be interested in one theme. Their possessions tend to be very organized and they're displayed. And there isn't a lot of financial distress associated with that.
Doesn't impact your life.
Yeah. Right. There isn't a lot of distress. There isn't financial distress. There isn't family distress about it. But for someone who's hoarding, they tend to buy impulsively. They tend to be in the moment and see something that they really like and they have to have it. They have a hard time organizing their possessions. So there is a lot of clutter. Things are not displayed. There's family distress. There's financial distress.
Is it common for adult hoarders to have displayed these tendencies as children, or is it something that happens later in life? You know, where does that begin?
Right. So I think people are oftentimes surprised to hear that hoarding behavior starts in childhood. When I was here last, I think it was 2018, the number that we were settling on was 13. But since then, there's been some more research that's been done. And the number that we're now sort of settled on is between 16 and 17 years old. But I know that in my clinical practice, I've seen kids start saving behavior much earlier than that.
So what does it look like?
So a lot of times when kids are young, they don't have access to the financial resources to go out and buy things. Not as much as adults can. They may be collecting things that seem like they don't have value or they're meaningless, like
rocks.
Maybe rocks or leaves yeah. or candy wrappers. And with children, what we're seeing is that they're very concerned with the condition of their things, the placement of their things, and the care of their things. And they get very, very attached. They don't want anyone moving their things. And if someone, you know, tries to discard their things, it does feel like a part of them is being discarded. They also anthropomorphize their objects. So they might say, I can't really get rid of this rock because the rock would feel really sad and feel very rejected and would feel very lonely out there. What's going to happen to the rock? I'm going to feel so bad that the rock is going to feel so bad. Mm-hmm. But really, any attempt to discard or move their things results in like an explosive response.
Yeah. And that's true for adults, right? If you want to get rid of their things, they feel the same way. Like you're throwing away a piece of them, right?
Right, right. You know, people collect and hoard for many different reasons, but one of them is it does feel like it's a part of them. Like I worked with someone who collected all of the hair from her hairbrush and had to keep all of that hair because it did feel like it was a part of her. And by getting rid of it, she was throwing away a part of herself.
Oh, my. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to join our conversation this morning. We're discussing hoarding. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're discussing hoarding this morning with psychiatrist Mark Whaley, psychiatrist Jonathan Swartz, social worker Jenny Putnam, and Denise Eagenstack, who is on the International OCD Foundation Board of Directors and the Scientific and Clinical Advisory Board. She's founding staff member of the McLean Hospital OCD Institute and has served as the mental health consultant for the Cape Cod Hoarding Task Force. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. So how is hoarding diagnosed then? We talk about some of the people have some insight that they have a problem and some do not.
Right. So we have a clinical interview and we reviewed the diagnostic criteria earlier, right? And so if people meet these diagnostic criteria, then they would be diagnosed with hoarding disorder. And then we would try to, you know, think about gauge their level of insight and motivation. Mm-hmm. And if they have a fair amount of insight and they are motivated for treatment, then we would try to provide them with referral to cognitive behavioral therapy, either in person, in group, which could be, again, it could be delivered remotely also, but also we've modified it in a self-help group too.
Oh, okay. So is that, what are you guys finding when you're diagnosing somebody? Is it usually the person who comes in and talks to you, or is it a family member who calls and says, hey, I think we need some help here?
Well, I was going to actually ask you about this, Denise, because in my experience professionally, people come into contact with help or assistance begrudgingly, to say the least, and that it seems like when people are being confronted about their hoarding, it's because of circumstances beyond their control. For example, an older person who's being moved into some kind of assisted living or retirement apartment, where now their cluttering is subject to inspection by the people who run the building, and their hoarding is now seen as a fire threat or a threat of their safety when they're subject to these periodic inspections. I have yet to see someone come to me and sort of voluntarily ask for help for their hoarding. It's usually their child, their son-in-law, or some other person, and then they might see, you know, that, yeah, they can see that they have a problem, but it's so painful, so painful even to begin. I often wonder when I see that program on TV about people who hoard, who seem to be openly requesting help, even if it is a little painful for them. I'm sort of interested in what your experience is with people actually sort of coming to the professional and saying, gee, you know, I think I have a problem. What can I do about it?
Right. Just want to address the hoarding show. That's definitely not representative of what treatment is really like. It's reality TV.
It's TV.
The International OCD Foundation has sort of taken a stance against that. So that's our official position.
Well, and just for a second, they say reality TV, but a lot of that is acting, right? It's set up. It's not real.
No, it's not real. Yeah. But it's sensationalized, yeah. And it's not real treatment. And it's generally one room, and it gets rehoarded fairly quickly after the show ends. But you're right. A lot of times, well, okay, so let's back up for a second. We talked about the fact that hoarding behavior starts in adolescence, early childhood or adolescence. And with each passing decade, it gets worse. There's a chronic course here. It's one of the mental health conditions that worsens over time. And people end up coming to treatment at around age 50. And it's about that time that the accumulated stuff really starts to interfere in their life, right? Mm-hmm. So their children may say, you have a real problem. Someone will call me and say, my daughter says I have a problem. Or you're right, like, I'm going to get kicked out of my house. Or a social worker will call me and say, I'm working with someone who's about to lose their housing. Or, you know, another family member that says, I'm really worried about my parent. Sometimes we have people come and says, you know, like, my child won't let their grandchildren come to the house. I need to clean up. Or my relationship is about to end. I really need to do something about this. But they're generally coming because of a consequence in their life, because of their things. If people are self-referred, obviously they're going to do better in treatment. They have greater insight. They have greater motivation. And that those are the people that the treatment works for. But when people have low insight, they tend to be pretty defensive and angry when treatment is sort of being forced on them by their community, by their families, by their spouses.
In a way, you can sort of see why they would be upset, right? I mean, it's like, how am I hurting anybody, right? So I sort of can see why they would feel. Mark, I'm sorry, were going to say something.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention, we haven't mentioned the word shame. There's a lot of shame that these people have. And I've seen patients, you know, treated them for depression, anxiety problems, or PTSD problems. And after knowing them for a year or two, I get a hint that they're a hoarder. You know, they don't, they keep it quiet.
That's absolutely
and
right.
Hidden.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
They try to keep it hidden.
Right. I think it's probably a good time to mention that 50% of people with hoarding disorder have a co-occurring mental health disorder. So like depression, 50% of people with hoarding disorder have depression. 24% of people with hoarding have social phobia and generalized anxiety disorder. There's also a high prevalence rate of co-occurring ADHD. Mm. So you might be seeing people for depression, for social phobia, generalized anxiety disorder. And once you develop a relationship with them, like you just said, you'll get a whiff of the fact that there's something else going on there.
And you can't really tell. I was telling you the story before we went on the air. I was at the grocery store and I saw this very attractive older woman dressed impeccably. And we happened to be going out to our cars at the same time. And as I saw her trying to get into her car, trying to squeeze into her car, completely full of all kinds of stuff, mm-hmm. I was like, it surprised me.
Right.
You just don't know.
Right. Sometimes it's not so obvious. But I would venture to guess that at her home, she had many, many, many hoarded, beautiful clothes, expensive, mm-hmm. beautiful clothes, but probably not hung up, probably couldn't find it under piles of on her couches and on her bed and in her bathtub and all over the place. And it probably took her quite a lot of time to put that ensemble together. But that when she stepped out into the world and looked beautiful and got compliments back, that's part of the hoarding process because it brings you pleasure and joy. And, you know, like this rediscovered outfit that she loves so much that people really love, that is going to reinforce the hoarding cycle.
Yeah. So, oh, go ahead.
I was curious about the relationship to adoption and hoarding? Because I know when I was in New York City and I got some referrals from adoption agencies, they referred to adopted children hoarding. I don't know if it's the same phenomenon. Food, clothes, toys were the three things that they tended to like squirrel away in little holes and keep and not want anybody to touch. Is that related? I mean, that's obviously a trauma response. Is it
right? Right. I think I would. Well, I guess it's also important to note that many people that have hoarding disorder report traumatic life experiences or childhood trauma. And with children, when we're looking at their hoarding behavior, a lot of times it's the attachment, right? It's the attachment to things. And so I don't know of any specific literature talking about adoption and hoarding behavior, but I think it makes perfect sense when you understand what these kids have been through and the loss they've been through and their sense of control, not really having much control over other parts of their life, but needing to control their possessions as a way of managing their emotions. I think that makes a lot of sense. Mm.
Is there a
I don't think we've specified has to do with trauma. And the first person I encountered with this was my grandmother. She was a woman who spent half her life or childhood and up to early adulthood in Russia. When she was older and had memory problems and was in a nursing home, she had a habit of bringing rolls from the dining room wrapped up in napkins and hidden under her underwear. She wouldn't be convinced that she didn't need to do this. And periodically you'd have to go into her underwear and remove all the stale rolls.
Right.
But it just raises the issue of trauma being one of the factors that leads to this.
Right. And many people who've had trauma will say that their possessions bring them a sense of comfort and safety. Right. And many times people who've been failed by other human beings develop a relationship with their things and they like prefer to spend time with their things than they do with other people. So trauma is absolutely woven in there. And it's one of the vulnerability factors when you're thinking about the cognitive behavioral model of hoarding. One of the vulnerability factors is trauma.
And it makes sense.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Is there a genetic factor?
Yes, right. There is. A lot of the data that we have about hoarding disorder are from the days when we considered it OCD. And so it's all sort of lumped in with OCD. But since 2013 and we've split it out, we have other data. It's all in its infancy, right? But we do know that 80% of people who have hoarding disorder grew up in a home where another adult had hoarded. So you see that it runs in families. Yes. So genetics is another vulnerability factor when you're thinking about the development of the disorder.
I want to mention that the context of evolution. We're everybody evolved with survival at its as the peak goal, hoarding or gathering things is really an expression of survival, holding on to things that will protect you in the event of something happening. People who hoard things, I believe, are very troubled by uncertainty and very anxious people in general. This has been one of their solutions, a maladaptive one when it gets extreme, but it's still a solution. I just want to introduce the other thing, which you also touched on, is socioeconomic status. I looked up whether there's some research on that, and thanks to artificial intelligence, it tells me that socioeconomic status isn't necessarily directly related, but it is related to the severity of it. How severe it is, so that people who are poor will generally have more severe syndromes than people who are wealthy.
Why is that? You would think it would be the other way around, because if you're poor, you don't have the money to go out and buy all these things that you would have.
They still collect. They collect,
just collect
newspapers,
different
things.
Yeah.
For instance.
Gotcha.
Cans, maybe, or anything that they can find. Remember, they're trying to soothe themselves and protect their their vulnerabilities. Mm-hmm. If you look at it from an evolutionary standpoint. Mm-hmm. The other thing is, one thing that's been linked with hoarding is people who are wealthy. They hoard money and gather it, even though they can't possibly spend it. But they hoard it and hold it, and they have a sense of protection, power, and we know how they influence our government so that they can keep more of it. That I think, you know, that would never be called hoarding necessarily, because we, in America, we value money.
Well, so there is a psychiatric diagnosis, obsessive compulsive personality disorder, which is confusing because it's not that again is not OCD, but it's sort of people approach life as like my way or the highway, but their hoarding is oftentimes the symptom of that, and there is a fiscal part of that where people really do not want to spend money, they do hoard their money. So I think that might be. Yeah. Maybe what you're referring to.
I want to go back to when you're talking about the genetic vulnerabilities. Now, if you have a parent who's hoarding and not extreme, it's somewhere in the middle, right? Like maybe a little more than collecting. Mm-hmm. Would you say that the kids could go one way or the other? I mean, is it like you're more at risk for hoarding, or would you be like, I'm not going to do that when I'm an adult?
Well, yeah. So when you're thinking about the cognitive behavioral model of how hoarding develops, we're starting with a set of vulnerabilities. One of them is there's a genetic history. Another one is trauma, we talked mm-hmm. about. Another one is poor executive functioning. Another one is the environment in which you grew up in, so it's learned behavior. So oftentimes we'll see people who, you know, repeat the hoarding pattern, or sometimes you'll see children go the exact opposite and throw everything away, mm-hmm. where it's not a decision. A lot of times it's not really a decision to keep things. It's an avoidance of making a decision. And then on the other end of the spectrum, it's not really a decision to get rid of things. You're getting rid of things as a way of managing your emotions. Like, I don't want it to get hoarded. I don't want to be like my mother. I don't want that mm-hmm. to happen to me. Both ends of the spectrum are sort of emotion management strategies. Right.
Yeah. Makes sense. I was just thinking, now my grandmother, you know, she lived through the Depression. She saved everything, but she was still blows my mind the amount of stuff that she was able to save neatly packed away because somebody might need it. That would be my learned behavior. So mm-hmm. I'm like, well, you know, one of my nieces or something might need this lamp. Let me put it in the basement. So mm-hmm. for a lot of times I followed that same thing till now mm-hmm. I've got too much stuff, so I have to get rid of it.
Right. But you have we all have traits yeah. of things, right? Yeah. Like I have, you know, definitely have traits of OCD and perfectionism, and people can have traits of like saving and collecting. It's just it's not true hoarding disorder mm-hmm. until it really starts to impact your living, cause distress, impact your functioning day to day. That's yeah. generally the thing that we're looking for, where we're trying to figure out if it tips over the line to disordered behavior.
So one of the things
about the genetics is if you're using that they grew up in a genetic, I mean, in a hoarding household, how do you distinguish between nature and nurture? Yeah. That could just be nurture, right?
Well, I think it's probably both. Like I said, I think like having a family history, you know, we know it's hereditary, right? And so there's genetic research on that, and I'm not smart enough to tell you exactly where and what all of the data is, but we know that it's hereditary, but we also know that your parental attitudes towards things will also influence future behavior. So it's the environment that you grew up in is also problematic. You know, it's that whole thing of like it's an interplay between both, right? Mm-hmm. You're born with a genetic predisposition, but trauma may trigger it. Parental attitudes about beliefs might trigger it, etc. Right. It's an interplay.
866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more about hoarding after a break. You're listening to The Point. We're discussing hoarding this morning with psychiatrist Mark Whaley, psychiatrist Jonathan Schwartz, social worker Jenny Putnam, and Denise Eggenstack, who is on the International OCD Foundation Board of Directors and the Scientific and Clinical Advisory Board. She's a founding staff member of the McLean Hospital OCD Institute and has served as the mental health consultant for the Cape Cod Hoarding Task Force for over 10 years. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to join the conversation. That's 866-999-4626. 4626, our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. All right, Denise, so we've identified that mom or dad has this hoarding problem, and we want to go in and we want to help, and people want to go in and they just want to, like, clean it all, help them clean it all out.
Right.
That you don't want to do that.
We do not want to do that. We're talking about forced cleanouts, and it's a pretty controversial topic. Because hoarding is fairly misunderstood, and, you know, we come on these programs, we're like, it's a mental health condition. It's not a moral failure. People are not lazy. Because it's misunderstood, one of the first lines of defense is, let's go in and clean it out. To me, that's an emotionally reactive response as well. There is no data to support that it's effective. It is experienced as a trauma by the person whose things are being cleaned out. It has resulted in suicide. Mm-hmm. And not only does it not work, it's actually going to make the problem worse. When you go back and visit these people, they tend to have hoarded more things than before.
Right.
So
is it important then to get the person who's hoarding all these items on board? Are you helping them decide what to clean out? What is the right way to go about it?
Right. Okay. So when we're talking about interventions for the problem, we've talked a little bit already today, a couple of times, about cognitive behavioral therapy. That is the clinical treatment, standard treatment for hoarding. It can be individual therapy. It can be group therapy. It can be delivered remotely, and we've modified it as a self-help group. Okay. We're going to be teaching people, we're going to educate them about hoarding disorder. We're going to help them develop their awareness of the severity of their problem. We're going to help them learn skills for more effectively managing their belief system, which is a part of the hoarding problem. And then we're going to teach them skills about how to sort, organize, and discard their belongings. That's the treatment. Okay. I like group treatment because I think that it's a lonely disorder. People are fairly socially isolated and like there's a lot of shame, like we've talked about. And so when you get people together that are struggling with the same problem, you tend to get people a little bit more loosened up, and it's a way to build motivation. If someone is not ready for that, but they're going to lose their housing, or they feel like, you know, elder service, you know, protective services are going to get involved, or maybe their animals are going to be taken away or something, you might get people motivated to do something called harm reduction. Harm reduction is another level of intervention where we talked about this again earlier, but you are helping people to organize their possessions differently so that their risk of fall, fire, respiratory illness is lower. We might also use the task force as a form of intervention where someone wants to preserve their housing, so they're willing to work with someone like me or a case manager or home health care to, you know, form a team and just set these small manageable goals just so that their housing can be preserved. And generally, housing court or the health department will be patient as long as people are moving along in that direction.
You just said something really important, team. So you're going in, you're not like going, all right, we're going to just clean this stuff out. You're going and saying, here, I'm going to work with you. So it's not like a forced thing. It's not you're going to do this because I want you to. It's more of a, I'm going to help you decide what to do.
Right. With me as a clinician, Erica Woods as health department, Lori Miranda as animal control, someone from home health care, we have to develop a relationship with the person who's struggling. That is the most effective intervention, mm-hmm. honestly, that you build trust, you build rapport, and then you can work from there. And we're never really telling people what to do. We're helping them build the skills to decide themselves. Right. We will provide guidance and advise them. And we hope through a good relationship, they will take that guidance and advisement and they'll proceed. But we are really negotiating ahead of time. How can I be helpful? How can we get there? You know, you want to preserve your housing. I want to preserve your housing. How do we, you know, figure out a plan that will help match the outcome, will match the intention here?
Let's talk to Caleb, who's giving us a call from Osterville. Hi, Caleb.
Hi, Mindy. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Thanks for doing the show. I'm trying to find out. I suffer somewhat from this condition, and I wanted to know if there was some helpful websites or online, you know, resources that can be looked into, as well as going direct.
Absolutely,
I could take my answer offline if you like. Yeah, thanks so
Caleb,
much.
Thanks.
Have a great day.
So there are, and this might be a good place to talk about the Buried Treasure Workshop, right?
So on Cape Cod, we have the Cape Cod Hoarding Task Force. It is run by the Barnstable Health Department, chaired by Erica Woods, and we run, there's a on capecod.gov. If you go to the health department, you'll find the hoarding task force website, and we list resources there. If you you're calling to say that you struggle with this, you have insight and you have motivation, you would be a perfect candidate for something called the Buried in Treasures Workshop. This is the self-help group that I've referred to a couple of times before. It is a program that is run all across the world. The Hoarding Task Force, we wrote a grant. We brought it to the Cape, and we've probably run like 20, 25 groups over the years. I've run about 10 of them. I love this group, and it's a therapeutic book club. It's run over 16 weeks. It's highly structured, action-oriented, and we use the book called Buried in Treasures, written by Gail Steckety, Randy Frost, and Dave Tolan. And each time we meet, we go through some of the chapters in the book that, again, are helping to educate people about the disorder, help them assess the level of their severity, and teach them the skills to more effectively manage the behavior. I think, Caleb, you would be perfect for this group. Right now, we have them running in Mashpee and Harwich. They started in March. They're almost over, but it's in Sandwich and Dennis. We're going to start groups in the fall. So I think that if you go to capecod.gov. Mm-hmm.
And we'll put a link at our website.
Right. Yeah. You can find out information about that. And these groups are free.
Yeah. So what's the success rate for treatment? You talked about motivation. I imagine the people who are more motivated are more successful. But what's the success rate when you're helping people with this problem?
So again, if someone like Caleb comes and says, I have this problem and I'd like to get some help with it, the treatment is effective. It's pretty effective. When we're looking at the Buried in Treasures group, anecdotally, I can tell you that people have said it has transformed their life, but the data bears that out as well. 70% of the people will say that they're improved or much improved. That's pretty significant. And for people going through just more traditional cognitive behavioral therapy, if you can find someone, if you have the resources to do it and you have the time to do it, the luxury of time, again, about 25 to 30% of people would say that they're improved or much improved.
Yeah. Any more thoughts from the panel? You guys have been quiet for a while.
Can I just tell? I just want to say
good information. I'm just putting it in.
Taking notes.
One more resource for Caleb is, Mindy's mentioned that I'm involved in the International OCD Foundation. If you go to iocdf.org, we have a whole hoarding website where there's lots of articles. We run hoarding conferences. And there is a resource directory on that website. So if you were to plug in your zip code, it would populate with providers in your area that specialize in treating people with hoarding disorder. So that's another resource for you.
You know, Denise, I imagine that one of the hardest things, I'm just imagining being in your shoes, is when there's animals involved. So someone who hoards birds or cats or something like that, just because there are other beings whose lives are at risk.
Right.
Is that true, or is there a way you can help us think more kindly about that?
Right. So animal hoarding is fairly rare. I learned, as I mentioned, everything I know about it from Lori Miranda, animal control officer, and Dennis. But people are hoarding because it's mission driven, right? They really care about their animals. They care about taking care of animals and saving animals. And they just end up having too many, or they are overwhelmed caregivers. They've had many cats who've had kittens multiple times, and then the numbers sort of spiral out of control. People who are hoarding animals care about their animals. They love their animals. They have names for their animals. They can tell you stories about their animals and will go to great lengths to keep their animals with them. They tend to, though, have low insight and low motivation. And so neighbors may call to report. If they had someone come to work on their heating system, the heating system professional may see what's going on and call. A family member may call and report, to the animal control. And then animal control comes out there and then sort of has to work on that. Animal hoarding is not about the number of animals someone has. You can have 20 cats and have it be okay. Animal hoarding is diagnosed when you are not able to meet the minimum requirements of nutrition and shelter and veterinary care that your animal needs, and that you fail to respond when meeting those needs has taken a turn for the worse, when they deteriorate. So that is when there's animal hoarding. Now, some cities have bylaws that say you cannot have 20 cats, right? But the sheer number in and of itself is not the problem. It's your failure to care for the animals and then respond accordingly when things have deteriorated.
So I'm recalling a home I went into in New Jersey with a friend of mine who was trying to get a rescue guinea pig. Mm. And the entire house was just guinea pigs. Everywhere.
Right. Oh, wow. So let me tell you about guinea pigs. Guinea pigs, I now know this. Guinea pigs can have up to 7 litters a year. Ooh. And guinea pigs they can sexually reproduce at 3 weeks. Oh, and so it is very easy for guinea pigs to reproduce over and over and over and for a house to be overrun with guinea pigs. Yes. Oh, right.
Saying that does not necessarily mean boarding, because when we saw it, we thought, oh, this is a, she's also a psych, you know, a psych person.
Right. So. But if those guinea pigs were fed well, had appropriate shelter and had appropriate veterinary care, right? That's not animal hoarding, right? It's not hoarding.
I think they had shelter better, better than the family did, and food, but not vet care.
Because they weren't being spayed and neutered. Yeah.
There were a number of sickly ones.
Right.
So now when you go in and you help some of these folks, do you go back later and see the success stories or if they've relapsed and is it common to relapse?
Well, home visits is being able to go into someone's home is a very important part of being able to help them manage this problem. You need to sort of be in, they can't just come to your office and talk about it.
Right.
If they're coming to your office, they really need to be bringing things and sorting and discarding and, you know, making decisions about these things with you, because that's all the skills acquisition and the skills application. But part of how I got into this is that I treated people with OCD and I only did home-based therapy. So prior to COVID, I was only going into people's homes. And so I did a lot of this work. You have to go consistently. And even when someone is sort of in recovery, you know, when their symptoms are well managed, you still want to go. You want to have them scheduled to have people come into their homes, like have lunch, you know, have your family over for Easter, or, you know, have your friends over for lunch, or, you know, I would go once a month or once every few months, because coming will keep people organized with managing their belongings more effectively. You really need to keep the follow up for sure.
And in a most successful? I mean,
absolutely. Yeah. Again, if people have insight and people are motivated, the treatment works. And so I don't want anyone to think that we're saying like there's no hope, because there absolutely is hope. And again, now more than ever, because, you know, with COVID, everything's gone remote. So we can, like, you have to have someone within 20 miles of your house to treat hoarding disorder. You could get treatment delivered remotely. Mm-hmm. And again, like I said, in group too.
So what are some first steps that you recommend for people who might suspect their aging parent or loved one has an issue with hoarding?
Mm-hmm. So the first thing I would do is I would read the book Buried in Treasures. It is, again, written by the three pioneers in the field, but it's very user-friendly delivery of all of the complex information needed. So you're really going to get a good sense of what it is and how to help. There are chapters or sections of the book written for family. So get a good sense of what's going on so that you can go in with empathy and information. And I would start off, manage your own emotions in this situation. Like, a lot of times people are very worried. They're very angry. They're very frustrated. And so you have to go into the situation educated and with your own emotions managed. Take responsibility for your own emotional response to it, and then start to talk about why you think that there's a problem. What are you concerned about? And then ask how you can be of assistance, right? You may have your own plan of what needs to happen, but that's not really going to be helpful, because what you'll end up doing is putting the person that is struggling with hoarding in sort of a fixed and rigid place where they are not flexible and they're not willing to look at things from a different perspective and they're not willing to get help. And I think if you can approach it that way from the beginning, you increase the likelihood that you're going to get some movement or some willingness.
Yeah, I'm on your side.
Right. Yeah. I'm on your side. Exactly.
Anybody want to add anything to that?
Well, I just was thinking about what you're talking about, like with kids, is it's just an oppositional stance that they have. And how you deal with that in therapy is a challenge. And well, everything you said was exactly right about managing your own emotions, trying to ally yourself with the patient and their perspective, you know, empathizing and putting yourself in their shoes is the best way to basically help and relieve some suffering.
Right. And we're using acceptance and commitment therapy with hoarding disorder right now, where we're helping people identify, you know, what is a life worth living for you? You know, what are your values and how can we frame working on the sorting, discarding, and reorganizing as committed action towards what you value? Like, I value having my family come for the holidays. You know, I value this marriage that I'm trying to stay intact. I value my health. I value getting my financial picture back on track. And then using that as a guide, mm-hmm. you tend to you know, build up some motivation for change. And you're trying to build, you know, psychological flexibility, willingness, and curiosity.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Do you have programs for family members to help them get there? Like, you know, if somebody's not really a reader, a lot of I often recommend books and people are like, oh, I'm not a reader.
Right. I think that I've worked with lots of families where they're like, my mom is hoarding and she's not really understanding that there's a problem here. Can I work with you for a few sessions of consultation to sort of help me understand and help me get ready? And you know, there's a few cases where I've actually worked with them all along the way as they were going in to intervene with their parents, like sort of coaching them along the way. And that's been pretty effective, too. Again, if you got to have the right stance, you got to have the relationship. You have to understand that this is a complex psychiatric condition, mm-hmm. And not a moral failing. And then you just got to be patient and set small, manageable goals from the place where they are willing to start as a way to build momentum and treat comorbid conditions. If someone is depressed right. and they are low energy, low motivation, you may need to be treating some of these comorbid conditions that might be interfering with right. treatment.
What about kids? We talked about this can start with teenagers. Mm-hmm. If you suspect that your child has these tendencies, what do you do?
I think I'd do the same exact thing.
Same exact thing.
Right. Yeah.
Anybody else want to add anything?
Well, I guess I would say that in my experience, exactly what Denise was saying is so important, and that is to have somebody who's viewed by the hoarder as a friend, mm-hmm. So that the work that takes place is not viewed as somehow punitive. It's not viewed as an attack. It's viewed as being helpful.
Yeah.
And I think having that family member or friend or acquaintance who's viewed as non-threatening, as benign. And, yeah. you know, you mentioned the importance of understanding your own emotions when you step into the home of somebody who's a hoarder. I think that's key, because anybody who is hoarding quickly picks up on the attitude or view of the person who's in their home. And if they don't see you as an ally, it's going to be much more difficult to accomplish anything.
Absolutely. That's why we do trainings with first responders and community organizations that may interface with someone with hoarding disorder. Because if, you know, someone walks in and they're eye rolling yeah. or they're judgmental, some, like we talked about earlier, there's lots of shame. People with hoarding disorder are going to pick up on that. It's going to put them in a very rigid defensive stance. Right. You can't work from that place.
We will put a link to the Cape Cod Hoarding Task Force at our website, capeandislands.org. Psychiatrist Mark Whaley, psychiatrist Jonathan Schwartz, social worker Jenny Putnam, Denise Agin-Sack. Thank you all. Thanks for being here and bringing us this important information.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Burdery and William Coulter.